Have you heard of the 4% rule before? And if you have, do you fully understand it? Well, I'm about to explain everything you ever wanted to know about it in this, the second episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast.
Welcome to the Retirement Planning Education Podcast, where you can learn all about IRAs and Roth IRAs, employer retirement plans, taxes, Social Security, Medicare, portfolio withdrawal strategies, annuities, estate planning, and much more. And now here's your host, Andy Panko.
Welcome everybody to the second episode of the Retirement Planning Education Podcast. I am your host, Andy Panko. Thank you for joining me. I'm happy you're here. Today's topic is all about the 4% rule. I'll explain how it's not actually a rule, how it was never intended to be a rule, but the industry has since taken it on and called it a rule and many times put it into practice as if it's a rule. So without further ado, let's get into it. The 4% rule came from research originally put forth by a financial advisor named Bill Bengen, B-E-N-G-E-N, published in the October 1994 issue of the Journal of Financial Planning, industry magazine, you know, written for and by financial planners. Now, Bengen was a sharp dude. He went to MIT for aeronautical engineering before going into his family's drink business, drink distributor business, and then eventually becoming a financial advisor in California. It wasn't originally called a rule, as I mentioned. In fact, the name of the article, the research that Bengen published in 94, was called Determining Withdrawal Rates Using Historical Data. So the whole point of why he did this was prior to then, there wasn't really a well-fleshed-out process or analytical framework for trying to figure out, for a given amount of investable portfolio assets, how much money people can safely take out each year through their retirements, where a typical retirement was assumed to be approximately 30 years. You retire early 60s, let's say, and let's assume you live until early 90s, which is higher than the average life expectancy, but still, you'd rather have too much than have too little. So let's assume you're going to live 30-ish years, or at least your retirement is going to be 30-ish years. But point is, prior to Bengen doing this research, there wasn't really a process around it. What people used to do, what advisors used to do, was say, well, historically speaking, you have a portfolio that's invested in half stocks, half bonds. The average return is 6% or 7% or whatever it is. Therefore, the basic back of the envelope math was that, well, okay, you can take out 6% per year, 7% per year. And on the surface, yeah, it made sense. Again, if you're averaging returns of, let's say, 6% per year, you can take out 6% per year. In theory, you're just taking out gains. You're not ever really touching principal. But when there are bad years, when you do have those less than 6% years, the super, super basic math was, okay, if you take out, again, about the amount of your average portfolio returns, you should be fine, with the emphasis on should be fine. Again, there wasn't really lots of data or research belying that super kind of ham-handed approach to distributing a portfolio. So Bengen set out to do research, put pen to paper, look at actual historical data, going back as far as he can reasonably get data for, and say with a typical 30-year retirement and assuming a portfolio of roughly half stocks to bonds, which is fairly common for retirees, how much money can you take out, consistently take out with, historically speaking, no risk or negligible risk of that portfolio depleting over 30 years? So the way he set this up, he assumed a portfolio of 50-50, half and half, of stocks to bonds. Specifically, stocks were just U.S. stocks. He used the S&P 500 as the benchmark, or as the assumed stock investment. And the bond portion was solely made up of United States Treasury securities, Treasury bonds, specifically those with what's called intermediate maturities. So not bonds that mature in 1 year, not bonds that mature in 30, but typically 5 to 10 years is what's generally called intermediate term maturities or intermediate term treasury securities. So this was a hypothetical portfolio, and the assumption was it would be rebalanced every year. Stocks and bonds move different relative to one another. You may start off 50-50, but over time, as stocks go up, your portfolio is going to creep to 60-40 stocks to bonds. Or as stocks go down, it can creep down to 40-60 stocks to bonds. So every year, you rebalance to bring it back to 50-50. again, he went back as far as he had or could find respectable data for. So the analysis started with if someone were to retire in 1926 and have a 30-year retirement period with a portfolio size of X, you know, how much money can they withdraw consistently each year starting in 1926? And then what if someone else started retirement in 1927 and their retirement lasted 30 years, how much money can they withdraw? What if they started in 1928, et cetera, et cetera, all the way up to the most current assumed retirement start date was 1976. What if someone retired in 1976, had an assumed 30-year retirement and wanted to figure out how much money they can consistently withdraw and ideally, you know, not deplete that portfolio over 30 years? Now do the math. If you start in 1976, that goes through to 2006. Now, Bengen published this in 1994 using data up to 1992. So yes, assumptions had to be made. So what he did was for, you know, those years from 1992 onward, and even prior to the mid-40s, 1940s, I think data was relatively sparse, if I remember the analysis correctly. So I believe he used averages. You know, for the periods he did have good data from the 40s through the 70s. I believe he just sort of kind of extrapolated those out and assumed those averages, you know, on the front end and back end of that. So this analysis was far from perfect just because of lack of data, but he did the best he could. So anyway, the point was starting in 1926, assume a 30-year retirement, and then start every year thereafter, assume a 30-year retirement. So there's going to be, you know, some of those 30-year periods are going to be really good in terms of, you know, markets did really well, investments did well, and some of those were really bad. Great Depression was in there. Stagflation of the 1970s was in there. The Black Monday, 1997, you know, October 19th, I think it was, stock market crash was in there. So he wanted to capture this by all these different rolling 30-year periods of assumed retirements. So he had that data set up, and he said, let's assume, I should back up a little more. The assumption was, okay, what percent of that portfolio can you take out in the first year of retirement? And then every year thereafter, during those 30 years, increase it or decrease it by the amount of inflation or deflation that there is in each subsequent year. So just to put some quick numbers to this, if you had $1 million portfolio when you started and you take out 4% that first year, that means you would take out $40,000. And then let's assume inflation goes up 1% the following year, you would then take out $40,400. And then if inflation goes up again the next year, you know, by 1%, you're then taking out, I can't do the math that quick in my head, but $40,800+, you know, the next year. And you do that over the 30 years based on whatever the actual realized inflation is, or deflation, if there is deflation, every given year. So he started with, let's just assume a 3% withdrawal. How would that work? So using all these rolling 30-year assumed retirement periods, again, starting in 1926 all the way through starting in 1976, what if you took out 3% of your initial portfolio, each of those starting 30-year periods, and every year thereafter increased your distribution by inflation or decreased it by the amount of deflation. And every year, again, rebalance your portfolio to whatever its value is, whether it's gone up or gone down, rebalance it every year to reset it back to 50% U.S. stocks and 50% U.S. intermediate term treasuries. So when he started with using 3% initial withdrawal, in literally every single one of these 50 periods, these 50 30-year periods, the portfolio did not deplete any faster than 50 years, which means 3% was way too little of an initial withdrawal. In other words, and he just randomly stopped it at 50 years. He's like, okay, you know, chances are retirement's not lasting 50 years plus for people. So he just kind of arbitrarily stopped at 50 years, as opposed to seeing, okay, when does 3% actually run out? Is it 60 years? Is it 70 years? You know, frankly, it didn't practically matter. So in every one of these 30-year periods, starting in 1926 all the way through starting in 1976, the 3% initial withdrawal increased or decreased in subsequent years for inflation or deflation would have never run out, historically speaking, in any time period longer than 50 years. So the typical retiree retiring at 60, you know, chances are you're not living to 110. And if you did, fine. Under a 3% withdrawal, you still had, you know, you did not run out of money. So then he started tweaking this number up and down. And what if the initial withdrawal was 5%, for example? So if you have a $1 million portfolio, you take out $50,000 the first year, and then every year thereafter, increase or decrease it by the amount of actual inflation or deflation. Well, in Bengen's findings, if you were to take out a 5% initial withdrawal, it lasted only 20 years in a few of the worst cases. But of the, again, 50 different 30-year periods he looked at, I think 30-something, you know, of those trials, it lasted over 50 years. So even a 5% withdrawal, historically speaking, many more times than not, would have lasted more than 50 years. But the whole point of this isn't, you know, how high of a number can you end up with? It was more, let's minimize or try to avoid running out. Right? That's a much worse problem well, it depends who you ask, but I think most people would argue running out of money in retirement is a much worse problem than dying with way too much. Now, sure, dying with too much can be life unlived, as you know, some people say, which is also could be a problem in and of itself. But generally speaking, running out is much worse than ending up with too much. So the point is, with a 5% initial withdrawal, there were a handful of 30-year periods in Bengen's historical look back where the portfolio would have run out in approximately 20 years. So that's not good, right? If you happen to be on the bad luck side of history and the historical scenario that resulted in the portfolio depleting in 20 years plays itself out again for you and you're using a 5% withdrawal, Bengen's findings would say that historically speaking, that could be dicey. You could run out of money in 20 years. And then if you have a 6% withdrawal, it's even worse, obviously. There's many more periods in that data set where the portfolio depleted in 20 years or less with a 6% withdrawal. So where the findings ultimately landed was that a 4% initial withdrawal was, historically speaking again, the safe amount. Under Bengen's research and his findings, if you take a 4% initial withdrawal and then increase or decrease that withdrawal amount in subsequent years for inflation or deflation, there was no period in his historical data set where the portfolio would have run out faster than 33 years. So that was sort of the culmination of his research. That was the finding. And even then, 4% was the most conservative. It was the under the worst scenario of those 50 different 30-year periods he looked at. 4% was the worst case that would still last you 33 years. In over 80% of the cases, over 80% of those 50 trials, the portfolio would have lasted at least 50 years. So keep that in mind. 4% was the worst case, most conservative. Again, looking back only historically, which is one of the big flaws, and I'll address that in a moment. But even the 4% rule, if you withdraw only 4% initially, historically speaking, chances are you're not taking out enough. Again, 80% of the periods he looked at, you would have ended up with a portfolio that lasted at least 50 years if your initial withdrawal was only 4%. But nonetheless, that wasn't Bengen's goal. It wasn't, let's try to maximize how much you end up with. Let's try to minimize, statistically speaking, historically speaking, the chances of your portfolio depleting over 30 years or, depleting any faster than 30 years. So 4% was the finding. So that's how this sort of became, and again, Bengen never used the word rule. He never even used the word 4%. His article, as I mentioned, was titled Determining Withdrawal Rates Using Historical Data. It was the industry who ultimately picked this up and ran with it and started calling it a rule. And it was good research. It still is good research. The process, the way he went about it makes a lot of sense. As opposed to just taking out the historical average returns, because that can get people in trouble. So it has stood the test of time so far. Going forward, who knows? And that's, I'll touch on that, as I said, in a moment. But that's how it came to be, the 4% rule. The industry took it, ran with it, put it into practice, kind of uses this as the starting point for what a safe, relatively conservative distribution should be, using historical data as the justification for it. So it's now called the 4% rule, for better or worse. There's a few interesting things I've found in Bengen's research that I think are worth bringing attention to, there were three particular scenarios that were especially bad. One he called the Big Bang. Those were the years 1973 and 1974, where across those 2 years, stocks were down 37.2%, bonds were up 10.6%, and inflation was up 22.1%. Hold that thought. I'll explain what these mean. Next was the Big Dipper. So the first was Big Bang. Next event he found was the Big Dipper. This was 1937 through 1941. Stocks were down 33.3%. Bonds were up 16.7%, and inflation was up 10.5%. And the third was the Little Dipper. This was the Depression, 1929 through 1931. Stocks were down 61%. Bonds were up 10.5% in that time. And inflation, there's actually deflation. You know, inflation was down 15.8%. So what's the takeaway? If you didn't look at this data, you would think, yeah, the Great Depression has to be the worst scenario here. Because, you know, we all know epic stories of how bad the Depression truly was with the economy and stock markets collapsing. And as you saw, stock market was down 61% over these, three-year period. Bonds were up somewhat, 10.5%. But keep in mind, this research, these findings, there's really two big drivers. One is the portfolio side and the gains or losses the portfolio has. The second is the spending side, the inflation side, right? So sure, it's obviously bad when the portfolio goes down in value, but what if your expenses drop because there's deflation? You know, you're pulling less out of the portfolio year over year. You have to keep that in mind as well. So that's why what Begin called the Little Dipper, the Great Depression period, was actually only the third worst scenario here because of, yes, stock market tanked, but there was fairly sizable deflation, which meant people would have been pulling out less from their portfolios year over year as opposed to more. So the Big Bang, that was sort of the mid-70s stagflation thing. Stocks were down and inflation was painfully high, 22% plus inflation over 2 years. So that really did a ding in portfolios. Now, keep in mind, again, 4% rule still held up. So even with that big bang, with stagflation in the midst of this person's retirement, specifically, I think this was if you started retirement around then, that was the worst case scenario. And the 4% initial withdrawal still would have held up even under this, you know, bad scenario. Stocks down a third over 2 years, inflation up 22.1%. 4% rule still would have worked. Now, so some other sort of notes I have. The 1987 crash didn't make it in. So even though the S&P lost over 20% on one day, on October 19th, 1987, it was still up for the year. So the S&P 500 was actually up a couple percent for the whole of 1987. So as such, you know, that ultimately wasn't that bad of a year. It wasn't impressive. You know, it was basically flat, but it wasn't that bad of a year. So that didn't even really make it into any of Bengen's worst case scenarios in his findings. The other thing, since his data stopped up, you know, at 1992, this data does not include the tech boom of the 90s. So most of the 1990s, especially the latter half, stock market was on an absolute tear, you know, up double digits for multiple years in a row. So that I think that would have done well for a lot of portfolios. Now, to be fair, that bubble burst, as we all know, starting in 2000. So 2000, 2001, 2002 were not good years for the stock market. It was down, you know, double digits each of those 3 years. So I'm curious to see if and when Bengen or anyone else does this research, which I believe some have, you know, to see how this would have worked. So depending when you retired in that period, yeah, if you started right at the beginning of the tech boom, the tech bust, it probably wouldn't have been so well. And that could have been one of the stressed times in your data set, although inflation was relatively low at the time. So, you know, you wouldn't have that double doozy of significantly reduced portfolios coupled with significantly higher spending, you know, portfolio withdrawals. Some other things to other takeaways from Bengen's research. Again, the starting point was a 50-50 portfolio of stocks to bonds. His findings were that actually anywhere from 50 to 75% allocation to equities was ideal. And it frankly didn't matter much. So whether you had 50-50 stocks to bonds, 60-40 stocks to bonds, or 75-25 stocks to bonds, the results were all more or less the same. You know, it didn't significantly move the needle that much. Now, we did find having equity allocations less than 50% were dangerous and that you didn't have enough growth in some scenarios. and having equity exposure more than 75% was also dangerous for the opposite reason, you know, a little too much at risk, so that when these bad spells happened, the nastiness was amplified that much more. And as I mentioned, rebalancing was important. Bengen assumed rebalance at the end of every year, back to 50-50. And withdrawals were assumed to be taken at the end of every year. So again, this isn't something that moved the needle either. But in my basic example, I said you have a portfolio of a million. So 4% the initial withdrawal would be you take out 40 grand the first year. Technically, the way Bengen set this up was, since withdrawals happened at the end of the year, that first year's withdrawal would actually have been 40,000 plus whatever the first year's inflation was. So 4% withdrawal on $1 million portfolio wouldn't actually be $40,000 even the first year. Under Bengen's approach, it would have been, you know, 40,000 plus whatever inflation was, or maybe less. If there's deflation that first year, it'd be slightly less than 40,000. And I have, I guess, a suspicion why the industry sort of interpreted this as advice, sort of took this as a recommendation or guidance, at least for, a withdrawal approach you can put into practice. So Bengen started this article with a hypothetical little scenario about the future and what it might look like. Again, he wrote this in 94. And then he ended the article with an epilogue, and I'd like to read it to you. Again, keep in mind, this was Journal of Financial Planning, written for advisors, by advisors. So the epilogue said, "You've been planning for new clients using the methods described above, and it is very comforting to know that regardless of what may come in the future, your clients will survive. Their retirement is not dependent on the Fed or interest rates or the vicissitudes of the markets. You have prepared them to survive the worst that has ever occurred, and should circumstances be better than that, they will prosper." End quote. So, you know, even though he says he didn't intend this to be a practical put in place distribution strategy, the way he wrapped up this article with this epilogue clearly makes it sound like, yes, you know, this is intended. You can tell your clients, take out 4%, you're good, using even the absolute worst case scenario that's happened since kind of we've had decent recorded history of this, you would have been fine. So that's how this sort of came to be a widely adopted, sort of put in practice distribution plan. So I have some thoughts on this. And in, you know, in these thoughts, you'll see the pros and cons of when this could work, when it doesn't. This is just a ballparking tool. This is definitely not a black and white, end all be all distribution strategy that anyone should ever stick firmly to, for a host of reasons I'll get into. It's a good back of the envelope number. It's a good litmus test. It's a good just to know if you're within the realm of reasonable, you know, quick sanity check. So if you have $1 million saved, keep the number simple. Your retirement's going to be approximately 30 years, and you anticipate you need to pull out about $40,000 from your portfolio. You can use the 4% rule to say, you know, is that historically speaking, at least within the realm of possible? And the answer would be yes, because the 4% rule would say yes. You know, $1 million portfolio, you know, 40 grand initial withdrawal is a decent starting point. Because again, keep in mind, the 4% rule, although it's flawed and it can't predict the future, which I'll touch on, it was the worst case, most conservative scenario. 80% of the time, you would have ended up with a portfolio lasting at least 50 years based on Bengen's findings. But, you know, the past is no prediction. The past can't predict the future, or whatever that disclaimer is. It's too rigid. Life doesn't happen. Spending doesn't happen. Portfolio withdrawals don't happen in a neat, pretty, linear, consistent fashion. There'll be years you spend more, years you spend less, due to life, medical, you know, physical circumstances, hobbies come and go, people come and go. So you can't simply do, okay, I'm going to set it and forget. I'm taking out 4% every year. I'm simply increasing, decreasing by inflation, and that's it. Not very practical. A big drawback is this doesn't include taxes. It's just a gross amount of money taken out of your portfolio. So for example, you have $1 million saved, 4% rule, if you choose to use it, says you can safely take out 40 grand in the first year. Well, where does that money now go? Well, if it's all pre-tax IRA, for example, that's $40,000 gross distribution you have to pay tax on. And so whatever your tax rate is, let's just assume you got to pay, I don't know, 10% tax. So your net usable cash after tax is only going to be $36,000, not the full 40. On the flip side, if you're all your money is on a Roth account, where you don't have to pay tax on distributions, and that 40,000 you take out is a true 40,000 you can use. So keep that in mind. It's a gross distribution. You have to factor in whatever your, you know, the ding may be, the reduction may be because of taxes you have to pay on it. And if you work with an advisor, the traditional financial advisory fee model is to charge 1% of your assets. Do the math. If you're pulling out 4% every year, well, guess what? That advisor's fee accounts for one of those percent, right? Because if the advisor is taking 1% of your assets every year right off the top, that's already 1% out of 4. So if you're trying to pull out no more than 4%, you're left with only taking out 3% at that point. Again, if you're choosing to stick to the 4% rule. So now you're taking out only 30 grand on $1 million portfolio because 10 grand is going to your advisor every year. And keep in mind taxes as well. Like I just mentioned, if 30 grand is all coming out of an IRA, you got to pay tax on it. Then the net amount you actually get to keep and use is going to be something less than 30. One of the other sort of shortcomings of the 4% rule is that it only included large U.S. stocks, you know, large companies, large cap stocks, and treasury, U.S. treasury bonds. It did not include small cap U.S. stocks. It did not include international stocks. It did not include corporate bonds. It did not include any international bonds. I believe it was a podcast with Bengen a couple years ago on the Kitsis podcast, K-I-T-C-E-S. And he had started kicking around trying to refresh and re-up this data, you know, to add what's since happened after 1994. And I believe he said when you fold in things like international stocks and small, or at least small cap stocks, the results would have been even better, you know, 4+ something percent, because that was an asset class that he, for whatever reason, chose not to include at the time. So in reality, you know, most people who invest now typically have more than just large cap United States stocks. They'll have some international, they'll have some small cap, mid cap, whatever. So maybe that helps, maybe it hurts, but historically speaking, it would have helped at least based on, you know, what Bengen has said. The hugest drawback is this is purely historical, right? As I mentioned, the past is no prediction of the future. Who knows what the future holds? And with that said, there's lots of debate and question and frankly, some fights about it, depending where you're looking and where you're reading, about does 4% or will 4% hold up going forward? More people than not say no, that's probably too generous. I've seen as low as 2.5% from respectable, knowledgeable, trusted people. Some are as low as 2.5. Some are more like 3, 3.5. For example, Morningstar, the big research firm, in November 2021 put out a fairly large paper about this. And in their view, based on their assumptions and guesses about future market returns and future inflation, is that 3.3% is probably the new safe-ish withdrawal amount going forward. And why is that? Well, a few things. So stocks have been on a historic run for the last, 10 plus years. Now, not to say they can't continue. Who knows? No one can guess. But if you had to gamble, if you had to guess, chances are they're probably not going to continue the size of the gains they've consistently had for multiple years. So with that said, it's logical to assume stocks won't continue the pace they've been at. They'll presumably have to kind of mute down their average returns going forward. But more so, the other sort of big thing here is the bond portion. It's a legitimate, defensible, sensible argument to say bonds simply can't have the same amount of total returns as they had in the past. For reasons outside the scope of this podcast, which I'll do in another episode, I suppose, bonds have done really well historically because interest rates have pretty steadily come down over the last few decades. And without getting too technical, all else equal, when interest rates decline, bond values go up, and vice versa. When interest rates go up, bond values go down. So bonds historically have returned, 5 to 10%, depending what period you're looking at. I don't realistically see how it's going to happen going forward. The interest rates are too low in absolute terms. There's asymmetric risk. There's a lot more room for rates to go up a lot than there is for them to go down a lot. Not to say rates can't be negative. It happened. It is happening in Western Europe and Japan. But still, generally speaking, I think it's safe to say interest rates are likely to go up more than they'll go down, which means bond returns. I just can't see how they're going to be anything like they were in the past. Maybe they'll be low to mid-single-digit percent, but I in our lifetimes, for all of you listening, I can't imagine bond returns are going to average close to 10% like they have in the past. So that's sort of the two main points. And inflation, who knows about inflation? It's been historically low. The 30-year average is a little under 2.5%, but this year, as we all know, inflation is quite high. You know, Social Security cost of living is up 5.9% this year. Depending which metric, which measure of CPI you're looking at, inflation is 6, 7, perhaps 8%. Depending on your actual spending, it could be higher. You know, cars are up a lot. Building materials were up a lot. I personally, my gym membership went up 100% just last month from 10 bucks a month to 20. Now, 20 bucks a month, I think, is still reasonable. But point is, you know, it was high inflation. My tax prep software went up 50%, 50% this year. So inflation is real. Question is, will it maintain at this 5, 6, 7% clip per year, or is it going to eventually come back down? Now, presumably it'll come down. Exactly when, who knows? And how fast it'll come down, we don't know. But anyway, you know, that's the other wild card. So based on all that, Morningstar is of the opinion that 3.3% is the new 4% for going forward. But with that said, they did have some recommendations and some things you can do to help tease out a little more efficiency, to make that return and make the hoped outcome better, or in other words, potentially allow you to take out higher than 3.3%. There's a handful of things. I think 12, 15 things they mentioned. I'll hit on some of the big ones. Asset location, you know, optimize the tax efficiency of things. Taxes matter, which is why in my practice and in all of my social channels and outlets, I'm always stressing the tax efficiency of retirement planning, because taxes always matter. It's not what you get, it's what you keep that matters, right? So try to minimize the tax bite. So what they said was, and this is something I do in practice and teach about, is asset location, which asset types are held in which account types. Again, this is another episode I'll touch on in the future, but point is, some things are better suited to be in a Roth, some are better suited to be in a taxable account, some are better suited to be in a traditional IRA from a tax perspective. So that's one way you can eke out, hopefully, a little more portfolio life, portfolio longevity. Next point was limit fees, obviously, whether it's advisory fees or even the fees inherent in the products in which you invest. Like if you have a mutual fund or an exchange-traded fund, those have what's called expense ratios built in. Some are really high. You know, some are 1% or thereabout. That's probably a lot higher than it needs to be. Some are zero at one extreme. There's some fund providers that have zero expense ratio funds. But realistically, most funds, you know, anywhere from 0.05 to maybe 0.5%, depending what strategy, what fund, et cetera, you're looking for. But so limit expenses and fees where you can. When you do sell, when you do need to take distributions, Bengen's research and Morningstar's 3.3% assumption was assuming you just sell pro rata pieces out of your portfolio. In reality, the way to stretch things out a little better is don't sell things that are down. So for example, if stocks are really beaten up and depressed and you need to take money out of your portfolio, don't take some of your money from stocks, some from your bonds. Sell off some of your bond positions only at that point. Use that to meet your distribution. Don't kick your stocks while they're down. Let them have time to sit there and rebound. So when the price does eventually come back, whether it's 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, who knows, when the price does come back, you still have all your shares there ready to rebound. Whereas if you were to have sold them when they were down, that's that many less shares you have to catch the eventual rebound when it happens. So you can stretch out a little more portfolio life that way. Here's some obvious ones, which may not be acceptable to some people, but simply tolerate a lower success rate. So keep in mind the 4% rule was, historically speaking, no chance of depleting your portfolio faster in 33 years. If you start ticking it up a little bit to 4.2%, 4.5%, or based on Morningstar's research, you know, 3.3, I think if I remember correctly, Morningstar's 3.3 was on the assumption that you have a 90-something percent chance, based on their guesses and their speculation about the future, you have a 90-something percent chance of not depleting your portfolio. Now, maybe that's higher than it needs to be. Some people will settle for nothing less than a 0% chance. Other people may be okay with like 80, right? So depending where you lie in that spectrum, if you're willing to go down a little bit to 85-ish percent chance, then you can take out a little more. Here's another obvious one. Don't take out the full inflation increases. Now, maybe easier said than done, but I think in practice, a lot of people do sort of do this. If the market's really bad or inflation's really high, yeah, they may rein in expenses a little bit, or, you know, not pull out as much from their portfolio. That obviously will help preserve things. This is a big one. Maximize your other sources of income. Social, you know, guaranteed secured lifetime income, Social Security, pensions, annuities, right? The more you have of those, the less you need to rely on your portfolio. And then even if and when your portfolio does deplete, whether it's when you're 80, 85, 90, 95, if you have healthy amounts of Social Security, pension, and or annuity income that cover most or at least ideally all of your kind of necessary expenses throughout life, then you might be fine, right? Not to say, so what if your portfolio depletes, but you're not going to be in destitution if you have a healthy base level of guaranteed secure lifetime income, again, Social Security, pensions, annuities. So it's important to, in retirement planning, you know, make the most out of all this stuff. It's not portfolio management only. It's not Social Security only. It's not annuities only. It's not life insurance only. It's the big picture. You got to tie all these things together into a cohesive plan where all these things sort of work to complement each other. Another thing is having buffer assets like cash or home equity you can tap, or if you have a cash value life insurance policy, you can take loans against that. So if and when the markets are going through a nasty spell, maybe you don't have to sell anything to get the money you need. Maybe you temporarily, you know, tap one of these other buffer assets, pull some money out of your house, perhaps reverse mortgage. Maybe I'm not specifically recommending it, but you know, something like that's an option. Or if you have cash value life insurance, you can tap that for cash flow and quite likely not need to pay it back, depending how the policy is structured. And then the last one, very obvious, is to simply delay retirement and spend less. You know, enough said. I don't think I have to elaborate on that one much more. And I just want to reiterate, and I said this, this is just in the context of your investable portfolio, right? If you have at one extreme large Social Security and pension, enough that covers most or all of your expenses, then I don't want to say, so what if your portfolio depletes? But maybe your intention is to deplete it. You want to spend it while you can, while your mind is good, your body's good. Use it on fun stuff, vacations, discretionary spending, trips, you know, wicked pickleball leagues or something. I don't know, whatever you do. Maybe your goal is to spend it down. So when it does deplete, fine. You know, maybe you're trying to target to deplete it at 85, right? When you think your mind and body may kind of prevent you from doing a lot of things you want to do or whatever age you choose. Then it's not necessarily a bad thing to deplete your portfolio. In that case, you know, generally speaking, for people who need the portfolio to live as long as possible so they can really get as much out of it, different story. But point is, you have to look at all the stuff in conjunction with one another. You can't look at your portfolio in isolation from your Social Security or your home equity or your pension or your annuities or your life insurance and so forth. So final thoughts to wrap up. Nobody knows what the future holds. Absolutely nobody knows. That doesn't mean we don't all try to make educated guesses and predictions and frankly speculations about the future, but nobody knows. The reason why the 4% rule now is so questioned is that there is defensible data and reason to assume that 4% might be too high going forward. Maybe it won't be. We don't know. Again, we're looking for the withdrawal rate that will last under even the worst case scenario. So with that said, is 4% too high? Who knows? You know, the hindsight will be 20/20. It's an estimation tool. As I said, it's a litmus test. It's back of the envelope. It's a ballparking tool. It's a very rough sanity check. It is not, should not be a rigid, black and white implemented distribution strategy, in my opinion. Life doesn't happen linearly. Spending, portfolio withdrawals don't happen linearly. You may have heard of the go-go, slow-go, and no-go years of retirement. And generally speaking, spending in the go-go years is going to be higher than the slow-go and no-go years for some people, for many people. So that sort of supports, you probably should spend a little more when the mind and body are healthy, you know, your 60s, your 70s, and then realize expenses and distributions will sort of taper off some from there. So a simple linear 4% or 3.3% or whatever you choose to use in almost all circumstances isn't going to be feasible. So that's that. Hopefully you enjoyed this, my dissertation on the 4% rule. Hope you found it enjoyable. Next week's topic, I'm going to do all about taking a pension versus a lump sum. So, you know, traditional monthly payment pension versus taking a lump sum. I will walk through all the pros and cons in that. It's going to be a good one. Hopefully, you show back up for that. If you like this show, please subscribe. Also, leave a helpful review. That will help other people find this show easier. And if you like the content in this podcast, you'll definitely dig my Facebook group, Taxes and Retirement, the YouTube channel, Retirement Planning Demystified, and my monthly newsletter, Retirement Planning Insights, which you can find links to all these things in the show notes. So that's it. Thank you very much. I will see you next week.
The information discussed in this podcast is only general explanations and education. It is not specific tax, legal, or investment advice. Before considering acting on anything you heard here, first consult with your tax, legal, or investment advisor. Thank you.